By late afternoon, they had covered several more miles. The hills around them were smaller now. The plains weren't too far off, and once they reached the plains, Calgary would be relatively close. But even so, that meant several more days of walking, and Frank wasn't sure any of them were up to that, especially Salty. The old-timer looked particularly haggard when Frank called a halt and said they would camp at the base of a wooded knoll.
Wish there was a nice, icy stream somewhere close by so I could soak these feet of mine.
That sounds good. But remember, keep your boots on. You don't want your dog swelling up so big you can't get your boots back on.
Sure, Frank, I know.
Salty took his shirt off so Frank could unwrap the bandages and check his wound. A little blood had oozed from the crease in the old-timer's side during the day, which made the dressing stick. Frank eased it off and studied the wound. It still looked raw and ugly, but the flesh around it wasn't red or swollen. That was his main concern.
It looks like it's healing all right. I'll just bind it up again.
I reckon my feet probably look a lot worse. Dang, if the good Lord meant for man to walk, he wouldn't have given us critters to ride.
They kept their fire small and put it out before darkness settled down. The food and coffee made them feel better, but utter exhaustion was stealing over them quickly.
I'll stand first watch, then you, Reb, and you, Salty. That sound all right?
The other men nodded their agreement. Salty stretched out in his blankets while the western sky over the mountains still held a tinge of red from the sun. Reb didn't doze off that quickly. He spread his blankets, then looked up at Frank, who sat nearby on a slab of rock holding his Winchester.
You reckon Meg's all right tonight?
I'm sure she is. Like Salty said earlier, if there's one thing she's good at, it's taking care of herself.
This frontier is no place for a woman like her.
That just shows that you don't know her very well. A woman like Meg, with the spirit she has, isn't going to be happy sitting in a parlor and knitting booties. She's got to be out and around doing things and seeing whatever there is to see.
Yeah, well, one of these days she's going to want that parlor and those booties, I'll bet.
Maybe. Maybe not.
She probably wishes she was in a parlor somewhere right now instead of being Palmer's prisoner.
You're not helping matters, Reb.
Maybe not, but I can't help worrying about her.
Neither can I. And I've known her a lot longer than you have.
You and her... I mean, the two of you ain't... You're not...
Meg and I are friends. Good friends. But that's all.
That's kind of what I figured. Guess I better get some shut-eye.
That'd be a good idea.
After a quiet, peaceful night, they were up again at first light in the morning. From the pained way Salty was hobbling around, Frank didn't know how far he would be able to go today. His own feet were in pretty bad shape, and Reb's probably were too. Salty tottered across the campsite and sank down on a log.
You're going to have to leave me here today, Frank. I can't go on.
Salty, I...
Damn it, listen to me. You owe it to Meg. You already wasted enough time taking it easy on me yesterday. You got to go after her as fast as you can now.
That's not going to be very fast. I'm not walking too good myself today.
Frank came to his feet.
Blast it, I'm not giving up, and neither are you two. Salty, we'll rig a travois and pull you.
A travois? Frank, you've gone plumb loco.
Frank held up a hand to stop Salty's argument.
Blast it, I ain't gonna shut up.
Listen.
Frank lunged across the camp and took hold of Salty's arm.
Come on. We need to get up there in those trees.
Reb was already grabbing their packs and kicking dirt and rocks over the fire to put it out and hide the signs of it.
Who do you reckon it is?
I don't know. But the way things have been going, chances are it's not anybody friendly.
He helped Salty up the slope into the trees that covered the top of the knoll. Reb came behind them, bringing both packs and his Winchester. They took cover behind the thick trunks of the pines and waited. The riders were coming from the west, down the long, shallow valley between hills that Frank and his companions had been following. The sun had started to rise, casting its garish light over the landscape. That light was an explosion of red as the riders trotted around a bend in the trail and came into view. The splash of color wasn't just from the early morning sunlight. The riders wore scarlet coats, along with black trousers and tan, peaked, flat-brimmed hats. The brass buttons on the coats gleamed in the sunlight. Frank recognized the uniforms, and so did Salty. They had encountered a number of Northwest Mounted Policemen at Whitehorse the year before.
Tarnation! It's the Mounties!
Relief went through Frank, especially at the sight of the riderless horses being led by several of the red-coated men.
It looks like they've got our horses, too. They must have stampeded back towards the mountains when Palmer and Lundy attacked us.
Frank had gone in that direction, as well as searching north, south, and east of the camp, but he hadn't found the horses. The Mounties had swept up the animals during their patrol, though.
You two stay here. I'll stop them.
He stepped out of the trees and pointed his rifle skyward. Frank's shot sent the Mounties the universal frontier signal for somebody in trouble. Down below, the Mounties reined in their horses and wheeled toward the knoll. Frank saw some of the red-coated constables draw rifles from saddle sheaths. He figured they had spotted him by now, so he waved his Winchester over his head in a sign that he was friendly. The Mounties waited. Frank turned and waved for Salty and Reb to follow him. As he started down the slope, they came out of the trees behind him. Frank glanced over his shoulder and was glad to see that Reb had a hand on Salty's arm, helping the old-timer. One of the Mounties walked his horse out ahead of the others. Frank recognized the insignia of a sergeant on the man's uniform. He had a ruddy face and watched Frank with narrow, suspicious eyes.
We're sure glad to see you, Sergeant. Are you in charge of this patrol?
And that's as may be. Who am I addressing, sir?
My name's Frank Morgan.
Frank nodded toward his companions as they came up to join him.
This is Reb Russell and Salty Stevens. We've been set afoot out here. Been walking for a day, and our feet are mighty sore.
Americans, are you?
That's right.
The sergeant's forehead creased in disapproval.
You American cowboys are too accustomed to riding. Even though we're mounted police, myself or any of these lads could walk halfway across Canada if need be.
I'm sure that's true, Sergeant, but those are our horses you got there, and we're mighty glad to see them, too.
I suppose you can prove that, as well as the identities you claim?
Dadgummit, mister! Why would we lie about such a thing?
The men we seek are wanted for numerous crimes, including robbery and murder. I hardly think they would shrink from telling a falsehood or two.
You're after the gang that stole a bunch of gold.
His statement just made the Mounties more suspicious. The men holding rifles never took their eyes off of him, Salty, and Reb.
And what do you know about that?
I know the men you're looking for are somewhere ahead of us to the east. While you were circling through the hills to the north yesterday on your patrol, they slipped past you and headed for Calgary.
He was only guessing that the Mounties' horses were responsible for the tracks he and his friends had found the day before. But the look of surprise on the sergeant's face told him that he was right.
You do know something about this matter.
I sure do. More than you might think. Because I also know they're Métis revolutionaries, and they have 4 Gatling guns as well as the gold.
The shocked Mounties fell silent abruptly as the red-faced sergeant twisted around in the saddle and gave them a stern look. He turned back to Frank.
I think you'd better explain yourself, Mr. Morgan.
I'd be glad to.
Knowing that Meg was still Palmer's prisoner made any delay chafe at Frank, but he thought it would save time in the long run to lay his cards on the table for the Mountie sergeant.
Why don't you and your men get down off those horses? There's coffee in the pot, and we can always brew more.
The man hesitated for a moment, but then he nodded.
All right. Troop dismount! At ease, lads!
The Mounties swung down from their saddles and fetched 10 cups for coffee from their packs. The sergeant clasped his hands behind his stiffly held back and faced Frank.
Now then, Mr. Morgan, my name is McKendrick. What can you tell me about these Gatling guns?
I figure they were stolen from the U.S. Army. I know they were smuggled across the border by an outlaw named Owen Lundy and his gang. They delivered the guns to those Métis revolutionaries I mentioned in return for a payment in gold, which the Métis turned right around and stole back from them a little later. They ambushed Lundy's bunch and killed all of them except a man named Palmer, who's gone after them. Palmer took a friend of ours, a woman named Meg Goodwin, with him as a prisoner. I figured he plans to use her as a hostage if the law catches up to him. Clear enough, Sergeant?
Clear enough, but decidedly far-fetched.
Maybe so, but that's what's happened.
What's your connection with the guns?
There isn't any, except that Lundy used one of them to try to kill us a couple of days ago. I think he was probably demonstrating it to the Métis, and we happened to be handy targets.
And what are you doing here on Canadian soil?
We were on Palmer's trail. He stole some money from Salty a while back, and we hoped we could recover some of it.
That's right, Sergeant. Palmer was part of Soapy Smith's bunch over at Skagway, if you heard about that.
Now, Skagway's in Alaska, out of our jurisdiction. But I do recall hearing something about the rampant lawlessness that went on there before the vigilantes rose up and restored order. Should have been done by the proper authorities, of course.
There wasn't no law to do it, so folks had to take care of things their own selves.
Well, such things would never happen in Canada.
Do you believe what we've told you, Sergeant? We could sure use those horses of ours you've got. I don't think we could walk much farther.
You have bills of sale or any other sort of proof that the animals belong to you?
As a matter of fact, we do. We bought them in a place called Powder Keg Bay on the other side of the mountain.
I've heard of it. Never been there.
I'll see if I can find those papers.
Frank had the bills of sale from Parkhurst Livery in his saddlebags, which he had slung over his shoulder along with the pack of supplies. Actually, a couple of these horses hadn't come from there, but the descriptions on the papers were vague enough that McKendrick didn't notice the discrepancy. Anyway, Frank thought, three horses were three horses under sore-footed circumstances like these.
Very well.
The sergeant handed the bills of sale back to Frank.
Everything you've told me seems reasonable enough to accept, Mr. Morgan, although it does take a bit of imagination. Do you have any idea what the Métis plan to do with those Gatling guns?
No, but they've been responsible for two armed rebellions against the Canadian government. I have a hunch that whatever their plan is, it won't be anything good.
Indeed. My men and I will proceed with all due haste to Calgary, so I can wire my superiors with the news. You and your companions will accompany us.
That was what I figured on doing.
A hint of an icy smile appeared on McKendrick's lips.
You don't understand. You have no choice in the matter. For the time being, you may consider yourselves under arrest.
Arrest? What in tarnation are you arresting us for, you dang redcoat?
You're being held for questioning as suspicious characters.
That don't sound like no real charge to me.
Take it easy, Salty.
Frank turned back to McKendrick.
We're coming with you anyway, Sergeant. What's the point in placing us under arrest?
It gives me the authority to demand that you surrender your weapons.
McKendrick carried a revolver and a holster with a flap over the butt of the gun. He rested his hand on that flap now. Frank could have drawn his own Colt half a dozen times or more in the time it would take McKendrick to unfasten that flap and haul out the holstered revolver. Outnumbered 4-1, though, he didn't want to get in a shooting scrape with the Mounties. It wasn't just a matter of the odds, either. Sergeant McKendrick might be a stiff-necked, overly suspicious son of a gun, but he was just doing his job the best way he knew how. Wrong or not, he didn't deserve a bullet for that.
All right, Sergeant. We want to go to Calgary anyway, so we'll cooperate. For now. Don't get spooked. I'm gonna hand you my gun.
Carefully.
Frank reached over with his left hand to slide the Colt from leather and surrender it to the Mountie.
Dag-nab fancy pants.
Salty gave up his gun, too. That just left Reb. McKendrick turned toward him.
You too, Mr. Russell. Hand over your weapon.
Reb looked torn. Suddenly, he stepped back, and his hand flashed to his holster with blinding speed. He drew the ivory-handled gun before any of the Mounties could hope to stop him and trained the weapon on McKendrick.
Hold it right there, Sergeant. I don't want to shoot you, but I will if I have to. You're not getting my gun.
Reb, what in blazes are you doing?
Frank glanced at the Mounties. Several of them had raised their rifles and pointed them at the young man. They might have opened fire if Sergeant McKendrick hadn't lifted a hand to stop them.
Now hold on there, lads. No shooting unless we absolutely have to.
McKendrick glared at Reb.
What's the meaning of this, Mr. Russell?
The meaning is I ain't handing over my gun to you. I haven't done anything wrong. You can't arrest me either.
Again, that frosty smile touched McKendrick's lips.
I beg to differ with you, sir. I can arrest anyone I please.
The gun in Reb's hand didn't waver.
Well, I reckon you can try to arrest me, but you're liable to be in mighty hot water with your bosses if you do.
Oh? Why, pray tell?
Because they'll be in hot water with the U.S. government. The Canadian government knows I'm here.
Reb, I think you got some explaining to do.
Yeah.
Reb smiled, but didn't lower his gun.
I'm gonna reach in my pocket. Sergeant, tell your boys not to get itchy trigger fingers.
Now you heard the man. I'd like to see what this gentleman thinks is going to change my mind.
Reb slid his free hand inside his buckskin shirt. He brought out a small leather folder.
I'll toss it to you, Frank. You can show it to the sergeant.
All right.
Carefully, Reb lofted the folder through the air to Frank, who caught it and flipped it open before handing it to McKendrick. A badge and an identification card were pinned inside the folder.
So you're really Captain Russell?
That's right. Attached to the U.S. Secret Service right now. I was sent up here to try to get on the trail of those Gatling guns. Once I did, I was supposed to contact your folks, Sergeant, and let you know where they were so the Mounties could recover them. If we were somewhere where you could send a wire to Ottawa, you could confirm that pretty quick-like.
But we're not, are we? So I'm left with the decision of whether or not to accept this preposterous story.
It's not preposterous. You've got my badge and bona fides right there.
McKendrick shook his head.
Anyone can have a badge and an identification card made.
You don't give up easy, do you?
McKendrick gave him a flinty look.
I'm a sergeant in the Northwest Mounted Police. Of course I don't give up easily. And you are pointing a gun at me, Captain Russell.
For what it's worth, Sergeant, I believe him. Ever since I met him, my gut's been telling me there was something I didn't know about Reb. And I reckon this is it.
Salty squinted at the young man.
Was you really at the rodeo down in Pecos?
Yeah. I've been traveling around competing in rodeos for a while. Gives me a good excuse for being where I need to be when the Army and the Secret Service send me on a job.
Reb looked at McKendrick again.
How about it, Sergeant? Are we going to work together the way your government and my government intended? Or does there have to be a ruckus?
You're heavily outnumbered, you know. You can't hope to prevail.
I'll take my chances. And you're the one I've got my sights lined on, remember?
Frank finally lost his temper.
Blast it! While we're standing around here jawing, the varmints we're after are getting farther away. All the signs indicate that they're headed for Calgary, Sergeant, so that's the way we all want to go. There's no need for a pissing contest.
I suppose you're right, Mr. Morgan. There's no need to press the issue. Would you like your weapons returned to you?
I sure as hell would.
McKendrick handed the revolvers back to Frank and the old-timer.
You consider yourselves no longer under arrest.
I never really did.
We'll call this a truce.
Calgary was both frontier cowtown and bustling industrial city these days. The downtown area had numerous brick buildings rising several stories high. But around Victoria Park, on the Elbow River, where the stream curved up from the south to join with the Bow River, Calgary still looked like the cow country settlement it had been more than 15 years earlier, when it first grew up around the Northwest Mounted Police Post established there. There was even a hotel called the Drover's Rest. That was where Joseph and Charlotte Marat found themselves this evening, along with Anton Mirabeau. Joseph had tried all day to talk Mirabeau out of his plan, but the man would not be budged. Attacking the Mountie Post was one thing. The Mounties had killed Métis in the past. But the thought of opening fire with the Gatling guns on the crowd at the rodeo planned for the next day horrified Joseph. Charlotte didn't like the idea of slaughtering innocent people either, and she had tried to talk Mirabeau out of it. Mirabeau refused to listen. He just fell back on his stubborn claim that the attack on the rodeo would force the government in Ottawa to take the rebellion seriously. The three of them sat in the hotel's dining room. Mirabeau had changed from his buckskins before coming into town. Like Joseph and Charlotte, his ancestry was mostly French, so their status as mixed bloods was not obvious. Anyone who looked like a Cree Indian wouldn't have been allowed to stay here. The other men in the group were camped outside of the settlement, keeping watch over the all-important crates. Mirabeau sipped his wine.
First thing in the morning, we'll pick up the wagons and drive out to the camp.
He had arranged to purchase two large prairie schooners with canvas covers over the back. The plan called for them to mount the Gatling guns, two in each wagon, one at the front of the vehicle and one at the rear. The guns would be covered with the canvas as well, so no one would be able to see them when the wagons were parked at both ends of the rodeo grandstands in Victoria Park. From there, The Métis manning the guns would be able to spray the crowd with thousands of steel jacket slugs in a matter of minutes. By the time anyone figured out what was happening, hundreds of people would be dead. Then it would be up to the men in the wagons to make their getaway as best they could. There would be so much chaos because of the slaughter that the men might actually be able to escape.
Charlotte, you and Dumont will need to have our horses nearby and ready to ride. We'll be in a hurry.
I would think so, considering that you'll be fleeing from the site of a mass murder.
Not murder. Revolution.
At least let Joseph help me with the horses.
No offense, mon cher, but after today, I no longer trust your brother. I would prefer to have him where I can keep an eye on him.
I'm sitting right here, you know.
I know. Joseph, you have been a dear friend to me. You are almost like my brother. And someday soon, once Charlotte and I are married, you will be. But our cause is more important than anything else, even that.
More important than me?
I beg of you not to make me choose.
She grimaced and looked away.
After tomorrow, you'll see that I'm right.
He drank the last of his wine and pushed away the empty plates from their meal.
Oh, we should go upstairs and get some rest. Momentous events await us.
Joseph had reached a decision.
You're right, Anton. We should go upstairs.
Mirabeau looked a little surprised that Joseph would agree with him on anything, even this. But he smiled.
Fine.
The three went up the stairs to the second floor of the squarish frame building. Joseph and Charlotte had adjoining rooms on the left side of the corridor. Mirabeau's room was across the hall on the right. As they approached their doors, Mirabeau put a hand on Charlotte's arm. He might have wished to kiss her goodnight, but if so, he was going to be disappointed because she pulled away from him. Joseph, walking along the corridor behind them, was glad to see that. The falling out that his sister had had with Mirabeau meant that she was less likely to be upset by what happened next. Joseph looked swiftly up and down the hallway. It was deserted at the moment. That was perfect for what he needed to do. He took the pistol from under his coat and pointed it at the back of Mirabeau's head. Even as Joseph fired, Mirabeau was already moving, twisting around and throwing himself to the side so that the bullet from Joseph's pistol whipped harmlessly past his head. The big man's arm came up in a vicious backhanded blow that crashed into Joseph's jaw and flung him against the wall. Mirabeau lunged after Joseph and grabbed the wrist of his gun hand. Bone cracked as Mirabeau gave the wrist a savage twist. The gun slipped from suddenly nerveless fingers and thudded to the carpet runner in the center of the hallway. Mirabeau kept hold of Joseph's broken wrist and used his other hand to pound a couple of swift punches into the smaller man's face. Joseph's head rocked back. His surroundings swirled crazily around him for a second. Then a black curtain seemed to drop over his eyes. He was still conscious, but just barely. He heard a door open, and a second later he felt himself shoved into a room. A kick dug into his belly. Another sound came to his ears, but in his stunned state, it took him several seconds to figure it out.
Quiet! People will come to see what that shot was about. As far as they know, no one is in this room.
The red shot darkness that had descended over Joseph's vision was fading now. He could see a little again. Mirabeau loomed over him. Mirabeau had one arm wrapped around Charlotte's waist, and his other hand was clamped over her mouth to keep her from crying out. Joseph tried to move, but his muscles didn't want to cooperate. He shifted just enough to draw Mirabeau's attention. The man kicked him again. Charlotte struggled in Mirabeau's grip, but she was no match for his brutal strength. The hubbub in the corridor grew louder. Mirabeau didn't answer the knock. His iron grip on Charlotte kept her from responding. Eventually, the commotion died down, and the people in the corridor went away. When Mirabeau let go of Charlotte, she tried to slap him. He caught her wrist in mid-swing.
Settle down and behave, Charlotte, or I'll have to hurt you like I hurt Joseph.
Joseph watched through slitted eyes. His broken wrist throbbed in agony, but he found himself unable to make a sound. Charlotte stopped struggling with Mirabeau.
How could you do that to Joseph?
How could I? That precious brother of yours tried to kill me. Didn't you see?
Because he doesn't want to be a part of the hundreds of cold-blooded murders.
It's not murder. It's politics.
She just stared at him, aghast at his casual pronouncement. Joseph got his good hand underneath him and pushed himself into a sitting position. By the time he was upright, Mirabeau had drawn a gun and pointed it at him.
Don't make me kill you, Joseph. I'm not sure your sister would ever forgive me for that.
You're already beyond forgiveness.
Mirabeau's broad shoulders rose and fell in a shrug.
The cause comes before personal considerations. I understand that. Even if the two of you don't.
Mirabeau looked at Joseph.
Did you really think I wasn't waiting for you to try something, my friend?
You are not my friend. Never again, Anton.
I can live without friendship.
Mirabeau glanced at Charlotte.
And without love, if it means my people will be free.
How can you contemplate doing such evil in the name of good?
There is no good or evil. Only freedom or slavery.
You are wrong, Anton.
We shall see. But not if the two of you continue to interfere. I don't like to do this, but I have to make sure you won't ruin everything.
How are you going to do that? Kill us both?
Mirabeau shook his head as he stepped closer.
No. But you won't be interfering with me anymore.
Even if he hadn't been in such pain he could barely move, Joseph wouldn't have been fast enough to avoid what happened next. Mirabeau bent down, and the gun in his hand rose and fell. This time, when the black curtain dropped, it enveloped him completely. Meg and Palmer stood in the darkened doorway of a business that was closed for the night across the street from the Drover's Rest.
What's to stop me from yelling for help?
Go ahead and yell.
Palmer pressed the barrel of the pistol he held harder into Meg's side.
I'll just shoot you and be out of here before anybody knows what's happened. As many people as there are in Calgary right now, nobody's gonna find me.
It was a bluff, mostly, but he had a point. The exposition and rodeo had swelled Calgary's population to several times its normal size, and it was already the biggest town in this part of the country. If a man wanted to hide from the law, Calgary was a good place to do it right now.
Anyway, you're a smart girl, Meg. You figured out by now that I don't want to hurt you. Hell, if you play along with me, I might just give you a share of the gold.
I don't want any of the gold. You killed Frank and Salty and Reb.
You're just not going to get over that, are you?
What do you think?
I think you're going to come with me. I've got to find some place to stash you while I go about my business.
They had trailed Joseph and Charlotte Marat into Calgary from the place outside of town where the rest of the group had camped. Palmer didn't know the big bearded man with the Marats, but he seemed to be in charge. Palmer intended to grab the three of them and use them to force the others to turn over the gold. He couldn't do that if he had to watch Meg like a hawk all the time, though. He prodded her into motion now, herding her at gunpoint through the alleys of this busy neighborhood near Victoria Park. He'd heard about a place where he might be able to leave Meg and have her guarded. He knew approximately where the house was located, and when they got there, he recognized it from the description he'd heard back in Skagway. It was a big house near the railroad tracks, surrounded by aspens. The woman who answered the door wore the pinched, suspicious face of all madams all over the frontier. She regarded the two people standing on her porch.
Men don't usually bring girls with them, mister.
Your name, Alice Beale?
What if it is?
Owen Lundy sent me.
Oh, Owen. Where is he?
He'll be along in a day or two. For now, he told me that if I ever needed any help in Calgary, you were the woman to see.
What do you want, mister?
He let her see the gun he had pressed to Meg's side.
You think you could keep up with this little hellcat for me for a day or two?
A greedy smile curved the woman's mouth as she took in Meg's blonde, wholesome good looks.
Want me to put her to work, do you?
No, just lock her in a room and keep her there. Make sure she stays quiet and doesn't cause any trouble.
The madam didn't ask any questions.
I reckon I could do that, but it'll cost you.
I expect to pay. That won't be a problem.
Better not be. Although, if you were to skip out on me, I could get what you owe out of this one. Pretty quick, too.
It won't come to that.
Palmer gave Meg a shove toward the door.
Get in there.
Suddenly, she tried to break away and run. Palmer grabbed her and threw her down on the porch. The madam turned her head.
Titus!
A massive man with a bald, bullet-shaped head loomed up behind her.
Yeah, Miss Alice.
Take this girl upstairs. Lock her in Desdemona's old room.
You want me to quiet her down first?
Not unless you have to.
As the huge man threw Meg over his shoulder, Alice Beale leaned close.
You don't want Titus to have to quiet you down, Missy. I promise you, you don't.
Meg sagged in Titus's grip. Palmer smiled. He knew despair when he saw it. Meg wouldn't give any more trouble, and she would be here waiting for him when he got back. He'd be a lot richer than he was now, too.
I appreciate this. I'll make it worth your while.
Damn right you will.
Palmer left the house and headed back toward the Drover's Rest. When he got there, he brushed his clothes off before he went in. As he crossed the lobby, he looked around, but he didn't see any familiar faces. A quick check at the registration desk gave Palmer the information he needed, and he made for the second floor. A couple of confused patrons passed him in the corridor.
I'm sure I heard a shot.
Yeah. And didn't some woman scream?
I thought I heard that too. But where the hell are they?
Damned if I know.
What the hell's that about?
Since he'd been lucky enough to find out what he needed to know, he went to the door of room 5. He would brace Mirabeau first, since the man was the most likely to either have the gold or know where it was. He would deal with the Miraz later, if he needed to. The hallway was deserted at the moment. Palmer slipped his gun out of the holster under his coat and used his other hand to knock on the door.
Mr. Mirabeau? Telegram for you, sir.
At first, he thought there was no response. Then he frowned and leaned closer to the panel. Palmer's instincts told him something was wrong in there, and finding out what it was might prove valuable to him. He tried the knob. Locked. Well, there were other ways in. He drew back a little, raised his foot. Palmer went in fast, in a low crouch, with his gun swinging from side to side. No lamps burned in the room, but enough light spilled in from the hall for him to see a couple of figures lying on the bed. They were tied hand and foot, as well as gagged. Despite the gags, Palmer could see enough of their faces to recognize them.
Why, Joseph and Charlotte Murat. Fancy meeting you folks again.
The crowds started streaming into the rodeo grandstands before noon the next day, even though the competition itself wasn't scheduled to start until 2 o'clock that afternoon. By that time, Frank, Salty, and Reb were on hand, circulating through the crowd. So were Sergeant McKendrick and some of his men. It wasn't uncommon to see Northwest Mounted Police constables around Calgary, since the town had grown up around and taken its name from Fort Calgary, the Mountie post that had been the first permanent structure in the area. Frank and the others had arrived in town the previous evening, and as Reb predicted, all it took to confirm his identity were a couple of wires from the Mountie post to Ottawa. Canadian government officials had ordered McKendrick's superiors to give Reb any help he requested. The ruddy-faced sergeant didn't particularly like it, but McKendrick was nothing if not a man who did his duty. The rodeo seemed the most likely spot for the Métis to strike, and Frank was convinced Palmer had followed them here to Calgary in an attempt to recover the gold.
We'll be there when the folks start coming in tomorrow. If we can spot Palmer, maybe he'll lead us to the Métis.
What about Meg?
Either she'll be with Palmer or he'll know where she is. That's why we need to take him alive. I appreciate it if you could pass that along to your men, Sergeant.
Of course, Mr. Morgan, but I make no guarantees. The most important thing is stopping whatever atrocity these people have planned.
Frank couldn't argue with that. Hundreds of lives might be at stake. But Meg meant a lot to him, so he planned to do everything in his power to keep Palmer alive until the varmint led them to her. So far, Frank hadn't seen anybody he recognized. Neither had Salty or Reb.
There's too dang many people here. It's like trying to pick one ant out of a dang anthill.
Just keep watching.
Folks had come from all over to attend this rodeo and exposition. Horses were tied everywhere there was a place to loop their reins. And scores of buggies, buckboards, and even some covered wagons were parked near the arena.
We should tell the Mounties.
Although the idea of turning to the constables for help was repulsive to him, this wasn't the first time he had made the suggestion.
No! We have to give Anton a chance to see that he's wrong.
He's not going to see...
Joseph stopped. Arguing with his sister was a waste of time. Even after everything Mirabeau had done, she couldn't bring herself to betray him.
You two stop wrangling and take me to him. I don't care what he does, I just want the gold.
Joseph glanced over his shoulder. Palmer's hand was under his coat, and Joseph knew that hand gripped the butt of a gun. He and Charlotte had gone from being in the clutches of one madman to another. But where Mirabeau was obsessed with avenging the Métis who had lost their lives in the past rebellions, Palmer's only thought was of the gold.
He won't have all of it. I told you that. Some of it went to the purchase of the wagons.
Then I'll take what he has. Keep moving.
The three of them made their way through the thickening crowds. Palmer had held them prisoner since finding them in the hotel room the night before. He had freed Charlotte long enough to bind up Joseph's broken wrist, but that was all the medical attention he received. The wrist still hurt like blazes, and his hand had gone numb. After that, Palmer bound and gagged Charlotte again so that he could get some sleep. They had stayed like that until a short time earlier, when he finally untied Charlotte and had her untie Joseph in turn. Then he marched them at gunpoint down here to the rodeo arena in Victoria Park. Joseph hadn't told Palmer exactly where to find Mirabeau. If he had done that, then Palmer wouldn't have needed to keep them alive anymore. Joseph was confident Palmer would have slit their throats and left them at the hotel. Palmer was a fool. Mirabeau wasn't going to turn over the gold to Palmer. He wouldn't care that Palmer was holding the two of them hostage. But maybe Palmer's intrusion would disrupt Mirabeau's bloodthirsty plans. That was the only hope Joseph clung to. Joseph saw the canvas-covered prairie schooner up ahead. He turned to Palmer and nodded toward the wagon.
There!
All right. Go ahead. And if Mirabeau wants the two of you alive, he damn well better do what I say.
That's your fatal mistake, Mr. Palmer. Anton Mirabeau doesn't care about life. His only concern is death.
Frank climbed to the top of the grandstand, leaving Salty and Reb to keep searching lower down. The broad brim of his Stetson shaded his eyes as he looked from one end of the arena to the other. He still didn't see Palmer anywhere, but another thought cropped up in his mind. The Métis couldn't just attach those Gatling guns to their carriages, roll the rapid firers into place, and start shooting. People would see the guns and panic long before the first shot went off. They would have to hide the Gatlings somehow in order to get them close enough for the massacre. He and his friends still didn't know for sure that the revolutionaries were going to strike at the rodeo, but it seemed like such a perfect opportunity that he didn't see how they could pass it up. The Gatling guns were pretty big. Frank recalled that the guards at Yuma Prison had one mounted on a wagon. There were a lot of wagons parked near the arena. He turned to look toward one end of the grandstand, and there was Joe Palmer, following a man and a woman toward a big prairie schooner with an arching canvas cover over its bed. Frank's eyes narrowed as he peered into the shadows under that cover. Something was in the back of the wagon, something bulky under another sheet of canvas.
Blasted.
Frank knew he was looking at one of the Gatling guns. There was something else in the back of the wagon, he realized. Probably a second gun. He jerked his head toward the other end of the grandstand, saw an identical wagon parked there, angled so that if the other two Gatling guns were in there, they could fire through the canvas cover, tearing it to shreds in seconds, and rake their deadly claws right across the crowded stands.
Salty!
The old-timer didn't hear him at first over all the noise coming from the crowd.
Salty!
Salty looked up.
The Calistoga! The Calistoga!
Salty jerked his head in a nod and took off at a run, weaving his way awkwardly through the crowd. He couldn't move too fast because of the wound in his side and the press of people all around him, but he hurried as much as he could. Frank didn't see Reb, but he knew the young army officer was around somewhere. He made his way down the grandstand as quickly as possible, taking more than one step at a time and dodging around people arriving for the rodeo. When Frank reached the ground, he spotted McKendrick.
Sergeant, I found what we're looking for.
Where?
It's in that wagon over there. There's another one at the end of the grandstand. I sent Salty down there.
That old man?
He's a lot tougher than you think he is.
McKendrick reached for the whistle attached to his red coat.
I must summon reinforcements.
Frank grabbed his arm and jerked him into motion.
We can handle this ourselves.
You're insane.
Frank had lost sight of Palmer, but the man had to still be around somewhere. As he and McKendrick approached the wagon, some sort of scuffle suddenly broke out at the rear of it. Frank threw himself forward in a run. Mirabeau stared at Joseph and Charlotte in shock as they came up to the back of the wagon. He looked as if he was about to reach under the canvas to grasp the Gatling gun's crank.
Take it easy, Mirabeau. I don't want any trouble. You can see I've got your friends. Give me the rest of that gold, whatever you got left, and I'll let them go.
You're one of Lundy's men. I thought you were all dead.
I'm my own man, and I want that loot.
You're insane. The gold means nothing now. Anyway, it's long gone. I brought what I needed to buy these wagons, then sent one of my men back into the mountains with the rest of it. It will support our cause for a long time.
You mean you don't even have it anymore?
That is exactly what I mean.
You lie. I'll kill these two.
Go ahead.
Mirabeau turned back to the gun.
Now, I have work to do.
Joseph knew this was his last chance to stop the massacre. He threw himself at Palmer. His right hand was useless for firing a gun, but he could still swing that arm like a club. He smashed a blow across Palmer's face and grabbed the man's gun with his left hand. Joseph whirled around, lifting the weapon toward Mirabeau. Mirabeau saw what was happening and jerked the canvas off the Gatling gun so he could swivel it around. Joseph found the trigger.
No!
Joseph felt himself driven backward as his flesh shredded under the leaden onslaught. At the other end of the grandstand, Salty saw Reb and waved a hand at him.
The wagon! They're in that wagon!
Reb fell in alongside him.
Where's Frank?
Going after the guns at the other end.
Split up. You take the front, I'll take the back end. We'll get him in the crossfire.
Better hurry. Ain't no telling when they'll start the ball.
The men in this wagon must have been waiting for that sound.
Oh, hit the dirt! Yeah.
Salty hauled out his old revolver as he threw himself to the ground. Pain shot through him from the bullet crease in his side, but he ignored it. A few feet away, Reb's ivory-handled Colt was already out. One of the Gatlings dipped toward him. Reb flung himself to the side and rolled. As he came up on one knee, he fired over the revolving barrel. The other one still poured death. Salty gripped the wrist of his gun hand to steady it. Frank's Colt was in his hand even before the first shot rang out. When the Gatling began to fire, Frank raised the revolver. At the same time, Sergeant McKendrick drew the revolver from the holster at his waist and leaped to the front seat of the vehicle. Not the one in the rear, though. The canvas ripped apart as whoever was manning the weapon swung it toward Frank. He dived flat as the slugs hammered through the air above him. The shredded canvas fluttered, giving Frank a glimpse of the man turning the crank. He was big and bearded, and his face was covered with blood. He looked positively satanic as he kept the Gatling pounding away. Frank glanced in the direction of another pistol shot and saw that the woman had picked up the little pistol. Smoke curled from the muzzle, so he knew she had fired the shot. The man at the Gatling gun let go of the crank and lurched to his feet. One hand clutched at his neck where a bullet had torn through it. Blood flooded over his fingers. With his other hand, he reached for the rapid-firer's crank, evidently determined to fire it even as he was dying. Frank stood up. The man reeled back against the other side of the wagon's canvas cover, then slid down it, leaving a crimson stain behind him. Frank turned to look for Palmer. The battle, eventful though it had been, had lasted only a minute or so. Palmer was gone. Frank's heart sank when he realized that. Then a second later, he spotted what looked like Palmer's back, as the man fled from the bloody chaos.
Morgan! What?
Frank broke into a run.
Tell Salty and Reb I've gone after Palmer!
Frank bulled his way through the crowd, trying desperately not to lose sight of his quarry. Everybody was trying to get away from the scene of the shooting, but the crowd thinned a little as Frank left the immediate area of the grandstand. He could see the man he was chasing better now, and he was sure it was Joe Palmer. The man glanced back, and Frank would have sworn that Palmer's eyes widened with recognition. The hombre probably thought he was being chased by a ghost. Suddenly, Reb Russell closed the gap with Palmer and took him to the ground with a flying tackle. By the time Frank caught up, Reb was on top of Palmer, slamming punches into the man's face.
Where is she? Damn you! Where is she?
Frank holstered his gun. He could get it out quickly enough if he needed to. And it didn't look like he'd need to. Reb had just about pounded Palmer's face into raw meat by now. Frank put a hand on the young man's shoulder.
You better stop hitting him, Reb, or he won't be able to talk at all. He might even be dead.
Reb stopped throwing punches and drew his gun instead. He jammed the muzzle up under Palmer's jaw.
Well, he'll be dead all right if he doesn't tell me where Meg is right now.
A house close by. I'll show you.
Salty, Sergeant McKendrick, and several more Mounties came hurrying up.
You get that man on his feet. He's under arrest.
Reb looked like he might argue the point, but he moved aside and let the Mounties take charge of Palmer.
He's going to tell us where to find our friend Meg. You can wait that long to take him to jail, can't you, Sergeant?
Very well.
McKendrick turned to Palmer.
Lead us to your hostage immediately.
Just don't let that madman near me again.
A few minutes later, at a house surrounded by aspens, not far from Victoria Park, Frank and Salty stood at the other end of the porch, thumbs hooked in their gun belts, grinning as Reb kissed Meg. Salty dug an elbow into Frank's side.
Looks like these young folks don't need us old pelicans around no more.
I don't reckon they ever really did.
That evening, Frank and Salty sat in the lobby of the Drover's Rest. Salty was smoking a big cigar he had gotten somewhere. Reb and Meg were in the dining room, having supper. Frank had figured it was a good idea to give them some privacy.
You see the way they were sparking each other this afternoon?
I saw.
I reckon Meg ain't gonna be mooning over you no more.
You knew about that?
Of course I knowed it. I ain't blind, you know.
Well, she'll be a lot better off with Captain Russell.
No doubt about it. You're too old to have much to offer to a gal like that. And I gotta admit, I never was all that sold on the idea of her coming down to Mexico with us. Having a gal along might sort of cramp my style when it comes to the senoritas.
Speaking of being too old to have much to offer.
Oh, there's life in these old bones yet. I just wish I'd got my money back from Palmer.
After being saved from being beaten to death by Reb, Palmer grew eager to talk. He freely confessed he no longer had any of the loot he and Yamo Hopkins took with them when they escaped from Skagway.
Hell, I lost most of it in a poker game while Yamo was sleeping off a drunk in some whore's bed before we ever even got to Powder Keg Bay. I never told Hopkins about it because I knew as long as he thought I had the loot, I could get him to go along with anything I wanted while he was waiting for his share.
You mean we chased you halfway across Canada for nothing?
It wasn't for nothing. We helped save a lot of people from being massacred today.
Well, yeah, I reckon. But I'm still broke.
Frank shifted in his lobby seat.
Salty, don't worry about the money. I've got enough for both of us.
Thanks, Frank. But you're going to have to tell me sometime how come a drifting gunfighter's got plenty of dinero.
Maybe I'll do that.
He looked up and grew more solemn as Sergeant McKendrick came through the hotel's front door. The sergeant looked around, spotted them, and came across the lobby to join them.
What was the final tally, Sergeant?
McKendrick sat down.
6 dead, not counting the Métis, and upwards of 30 wounded. It's terrible, just terrible. But it would have been much, much worse if not for you and your friends, Mr. Morgan.
I'm glad we were around to lend a hand.
Well, what are your plans now, if you don't mind my asking?
Is that an official question?
Well, it might be. I've spoken to some of my superiors about you. They tell me that you have quite a reputation down in the States. It said the trouble follows you wherever you go.
So you probably just as soon I went somewhere else besides Canada.
Indeed. The Northwest Mounted Police are charged with keeping the peace, you know. I have a feeling that would be much easier without the, Drifter in our midst?
Frank didn't take offense. He had heard it all before.
Don't worry. I'll be moseying on pretty soon. Salty and I have been talking about going down to Mexico.
Frank turned to the old-timer.
In fact, I was thinking about seeing if I can send a wire to Seattle and see if the fella who's been looking after Stormy, Goldie, and Wolf could put them on a train and ship them over to White Sulphur Springs in Montana. I've got a friend named Bob Coburn who owns a ranch near there. It's really not all that far from here, as the crow flies. If we could pick them up there, we wouldn't even have to go back to Seattle.
Sounds like a mighty fine plan to me. I wouldn't mind taking a passeyard down through that Montana cattle country.
If I can assist you in any way in making your plans, Mr. Morgan, please let me know.
I'll do that. We'll be outfitted and on our way in a day or two, more than likely.
Again, Mr. Morgan, Mr. Stevens, thank you for your assistance. Good evening.
Good night.
Frank and Salty resumed their sitting and musing.
Reckon they'll ever have another rodeo here after all the hell that broke loose at this one?
I expect they will. Reb says they're the common thing, that they'll be holding rodeos all over the country before you know it.
Why in tarnation would they do that?
Because it won't be long until the frontier that we knew was gone, Salty. Hombres like the two of us are the next thing to relics already. People will want to remember the way things were, though. And rodeos and Wild West shows and things like that will be the only way.
It won't be the same.
Nothing ever is.
The Last Gunfighter, Dead Before Sundown, is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2011, William W. Johnstone. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2012, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Ken Jackson, James Konacek, James Keegan, Thomas Keegan, Casey Platt, Terrence Aselford, Johan Detweiler, Bradley Foster Smith, Stephen Carpenter, Mort Shelby, Alyssa Wilman, Michael John Casey, David Coyne, Richard Rowan, Christopher Graybill, Kate Foster. Directed by Ken Jackson. Book adapted for Graphic Audio by Timothy Lynch. Dialogue editing and Graphic Audio sound design by Patrick Stratton. Title theme and original music by Johan Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed The Last Gunfighter, be sure to look for the series The Loner, as well as Smoke Jensen, The Mountain Man, and Elmer Kelton's Sons of Texas series. Available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our action-pumped titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com.
The name is Chardine.
Why were you trying to kill us, Chardine?
I wasn't aiming to kill you. All I wanted to do was hold you up for a while so as to keep you from getting home right away.
You wanted to keep us from getting home. Now, why would you want to do that?
To give Van Ark time to catch your woman. I've done my job. By now, we've done took her, and I reckon you'll pay plenty to get her back.
Snatch my woman. Are you talking about Sally?
Is that her name? Sally? Well, now, that's a right pretty name. Yes, sir, it is. But then I've heard she's a real pretty woman. So I expect you'll pay pretty near any amount of money we ask for just to get her back now, won't you?
What happens when you take Smoke Jensen's wife?
Come on, Jensen, I gotta tell Van Ark something. I can't go back to him and tell him you didn't say anything at all.
You don't have to worry about that.
What do you mean I don't have to worry about that?
I mean you don't have to worry about telling Van Ark anything. Because you aren't going back.
Damn! That is the same thing she said.
That's what Sally told you, isn't it?
See here, I ain't gonna let you work on my mind like that. I damn sure I'm going back.
No, you aren't.
We got your wife, don't you understand that?
And I've got you.
Bear witness to Violence of the Mountain Man. Mountain Man number 36. Available now in Graphic Audio.
Wanderer, I had a bad dream. I heard a voice calling me, Wanderer. I followed it through a dark mist until I saw wooden stairs built into the side of a huge mound. I walked up the steps into this big round room.
Ah,
The Sun Chamber at the Temple Mound in Cahokia.
I wonder what the Cahokians want with you. Theron, the Sun Chief, is not a good person to be wanted by.
His madness started with Nightshade. Yes, Nightshade.
I hate this, Badger Tail. The Sun Chief has truly gone mad this time.
Theron frightens me too, but I cannot disobey my orders, Bobcat.
Leader Badger Tail wishes to speak with the great Moon Chief.
You're a bold man, Leader Badger Tail.
The Sun Chief needs a new priestess. He wants Nightshade.
She's not here.
Where is she?
We won't tell you. If you kill us, Nightshade will find you. She'll avenge us.
No! Father!
Pataga, you are the new Moon Chief.
So, you are mine again, Nightshade. I had no idea you'd grown up into such a beautiful woman.
Why did you order me brought back here, Theron? What is it you've done to anger the gods so much that they've abandoned us?
Don't ever ask me that again. Do you understand?
Hail Cloud!
Yes, my chief?
How many warriors survived Badger Tail's attack?
He left us about 100. If you're thinking of returning his attack, don't. We can't.
How many warriors survived at Hickory Mounds and the other villages Badger Tail has ravaged this cycle?
Well, it might work, my chief, if we can convince their people to fight with little food in their bellies.
Pataga is massing forces, war leader. He has already gleaned over 900 from the southern villages.
We must stop Pataga now.
All right, but first, before you attack Pataga, I want you to strike Redweed Village. And bring me the stone wolf that resides there.
But my chief...
I want that stone wolf! You will attack Redweed Village and get it!
Nightshade, tell me how to stop the killing. Can you?
No.
If you can't, who can?
A woman whom Wanderer is teaching. I don't know her name, but she's powerful. More powerful than I am.
Foe, grab Lycan! We have to try to get out through the window!
But they'll be watching. You know they will. They're probably waiting for
you. Foe!
Mother! Where's my mother?
Lycan, run!
What happened?
Run! We'll find you if we can!
Locust, what have you discovered?
About the Stone Wolf? Nothing.
Wanderer.
Badger Tail, it's been a long time.
Tell me where the wolf is.
No.
Why?
The wolf is a very great power object, but I will tell Nightshade.
Birdman, help me stay awake. I have to wait for Wanderer or my mother.
I hear you, little one.
Oh, Birdman, thank you.
Do you know why owls die with their wings outspread, little one?
They know that flight is their only hope of survival.
Will you give up, Lycan? Or will you fly for your people?
I want to fly, Birdman. I've always wanted to. Birdman, no! You're supposed to be my spirit helper!
Against the stunning backdrop of one of the greatest cities of the ancient world, unfolds an epic tale of madness and revenge, of passion and redemption. Don't miss the next exciting installment of the North America's Forgotten Past series, People of the River, in rich, vibrant, graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.